Hi, my name is Chris.
And I'm Mira.
And we are associated members of ML4Q.
And you are listening to ML4Q&A, a show where members from the Matter and Light for Quantum Computing cluster talk about their career, their research, and the future of quantum.
Today we're talking with Silvia Pappalardi, who joined ML4Q as a junior professor last April.
Silvia heads the Chaos Group, spelled with a Q, and today we'll dive into the topic of quantum chaos. And you know, many would like to learn about it, but it sounds intimidating.
For me, already the concept of thermalization or ergodicity are non-trivial. I hope to get some intuitive explanations and understand how these concepts relate to entanglement.
Welcome, Professor Silvia Pappalardi, on the ML4Q Q&A podcast. Professor in Cologne since 2023. So we have a new professor who's also very young. We are going to talk about entanglement, quantum chaos, thermalization, and what you can learn about Hamiltonians by looking at them.
Yeah, and drinking coffee and being smart.
Thank you. Thank you for having me in this very nice podcast.
Yes, it's a pleasure. I want to mention, like, I got you a welcome gift to Cologne, because I'm from Ehrenfeld, which is the most hipster like Veedel in Cologne, part of town, and because you are from Paris and Rome, and Ehrenfeld has this mentality that they printed T-shirts that say Paris, London, Tokyo, Ehrenfeld, because it's a natural transition. So also you coming from Rome to Paris to Cologne seems like a natural transition.
Yeah, thank you. The T-shirt is wonderful. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Do you already feel like Cologne is the Rome of Germany?
Absolutely. I mean, with its history, it is a bit like that. And also Cologne was founded by a Roman woman. So it was the Emperor Julia Agrippina who really said, please, to her husband Claudio, please, I want Cologne to be a city.
So. And apparently the only city who has this Colonia is just Rome for, I guess, big city or...
Yeah.
It's Roman term for big city, and it kept the name. So... Welcome, and you're indeed very, very young for a professor, and it's amazing to have you. And let's start much earlier and discuss a little bit how you got there. So when did you know that you wanted to become a physicist?
And that's a good question. So actually, in Italy, you don't have to choose very early what you want to do. Actually, you never have to choose. Just when you subscribe to the university. And I was doing this classical high school where you study Greek, Latin, and philosophy. And then, as many people in physics, I wanted to study philosophy. So. but then somehow I thought, let's do something very, very hard that I could never do alone. So I chose physics, but a bit randomly. And then at the beginning it was super tough, but then I really got into it. And so
when you started with physics, we can think it from the end. Now you're a quite abstract theoretical physicist. Was it from the start that you engaged with the abstract side of physics, or how was your journey as a physicist? Mm-hmm.
So I studied in Rome at La Sapienza, which has a big history of different kind of actually physics side. There is a very strong group in statistical and mechanics. I mean, so let's say the theory part was always something that fascinated me, mostly because of lectures and what I liked and the mathematical structure of things. And then I remember there was a colloquium at Sapienza where Elena Speer came to give a talk, and there are not many people doing theoretical quantum physics, let's say. There are very good experimental groups, but on the theory side, so I never heard about, so I was an undergrad, and the way he explained how he came across the Bell inequalities, and that he was kind of obsessed with it when nobody cared. So it really fascinated me, and I wanted to do quantum after his talk. I was like, okay, no, that's the way to go.
So the fundamental entanglement.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. That's a natural way to get into the field for sure. So very, very important point in your career to have a visit from actually experimental physicists.
Yeah, exactly.
The other thing is, I think, is Enrico Fermi, was he at La Sapienza?
Yes. So at the time when he was there, the main spot where they were working was not where La Sapienza is now, was in Via Panisperna. So it were very exciting years. So many people were there, Fermi, Majorana, and Pontecorvo, and they were called I ragazzi di Via Panisperna, the boys of Panisperna Street, which is in Monti, so it's a neighborhood nearby the Colosseum. But the main building in La Sapienza is called Enrico Fermi, of course.
Yeah. And he's the inspiring example that you don't have to choose experimental theory.
Yeah.
Right? You can just do both. You just have to be good.
Yeah, you just have to be Fermi.
Yes.
So talking about Enrico Fermi and Majorana, you yourself have had very notable mentors. So shall we talk about them? You have worked with also Giorgio Parisi, who received the Nobel Prize recently. So how was it like working with him, and what did you work on?
Mm-hmm. So yes, he was my undergraduate and graduate advisor. And I never had a class with him, but of course he had an aura around, let's say. So I went to him to ask the thesis, and I think one of the main points is that he's a super humble person, which would talk to a Nobel Prize fellow, to you, to the cashier at the supermarket with the same attention, which surprisingly makes you at ease also in asking him very simple questions. And he somehow dedicated me quite a lot of time. But I wanted to do so after this Elena Spe talk. I wanted to do something in quantum information. So I asked him, I was very serious about it. So I told him, I want to do the thesis with you, but I want to do quantum information. And then he told me, I know nothing about quantum mechanics. And then he started scrolling Wikipedia with quantum information to find a topic. And then, of course, he had done like 20 papers on multipartite entangled states and frustration in many-body systems. And so this is how it started.
Yeah, good start. Yeah. He's originally also a field theory person.
Yes, so he was the student of Cabibbo. So he started with that, and then so he has done contribution in every side of theoretical physics, I would say. Also numerics. So they were building the first supercomputer, APE, in Rome, which was so he has always so many stories. But he's also super nice also to talk about random things, about the history, about philosophy. He also always has stories about everything.
When you should turn off the heating?
The heating.
The pasta heating, yes.
Yeah. Also on that. Also, he loves to dance. and he's quite keen on that. Yeah, but after that, he has always been a mentor. So every time I had to make some choice, I could always ask him what to do. And so also before coming to Cologne, we had a chat and told me, go.
I mean, it is very important in science careers, right? Like, in a way, science is an apprenticeship rather than, at least at the level of really contributing to science. Like, of course, the university is more and more like school, maybe, that mm-hmm. you just take courses mm-hmm. and you learn. But once you become a scientist, you're sort of an apprentice and you have people really mentoring you. And
Yeah. This is true. So in his specific case, I never worked on spin glasses. So his main thing, I've always been on the side. So we have a paper together, but it's on entanglement. So it has always been a mentor more in choices or the way to be as a scientist, not really in the scientific part, because I never worked on his main topic, but I was lucky because I also had many other professors who were quite influential.
One thing that we can briefly discuss is the difference between sort of quantum information, which is rather simple-ish mathematics, and this quantum field theory or so on. Like, you know, like there's a lot of much more complicated mathematics than sort of simple quantum mechanics, right? How much of each did you absorb in your sort of formative years in Rome?
Yeah, so Rome is not really specialized on quantum information. There is a very good professor, Fabio Cerrino, who gave an amazing course on that. And there is a lot of quantum field theory, which also statistical field theory, which is... So I absorbed a lot on it, I would say. But then when I moved for the PhD, I wanted to do something more related to entanglement and many-body systems. So I went to Trieste in Italy, in the northeast, where there is this graduate school, which is called SISSA. And there everyone was doing entanglement and dynamics. And so in this field, like field theory... It's not really like the kind of tools that I use, but I was exposed to that a lot when I was a student.
So indeed, the sort of the mathematics of many-body entanglement, in some sense, is it fair to say that it's easier than like hardcore quantum field theory?
Well, I think it depends from which kind of side you approach it. So, for instance, there is the school of Pasquale Calabrese, this kind of conformal field theory approach, which uses field theory and it's very advanced. But the way I and many other people do it is more from a statistical mechanics point of view. So here maybe it's going back to Rome and this origin of statistical mechanics that pushes me. So in this sense, the math, it's different, and it's definitely simpler than field theory.
Yeah, I mean, for me as an experimental physicist, if you have some finite quantum systems, you know, I can still, at least even me, I can do some numerics and I can sort of understand a little bit from it. And it's a little bit less, I guess I couldn't do numerics for... for some more complicated quantum field theory things. So did this attract you to the, like, what attracted you to this?
Maybe I never thought about it, but it may be part of it, why. So as we say, so quantum information is quite simple, and also what Giorgio Parisi told me once is like linear algebra, no? So I was explaining him tensor networks and said, this is linear algebra. And I think a part of the simplicity and the beauty of it is also in that. But I think when you go many body, you really need to also add this kind of more statistical approach if you want to treat the problem.
So did you move to SISSA for your PhD?
Yes, so for actually I went there to do my master thesis, and which was in co-supervision with Rome, and this is where really my interest in entanglement and out of equilibrium many-body physics started, because there it's quite a center for these topics.
And you worked on quantum chaos.
Yes, and so this is something I started to do at the end of the PhD and mostly also in the postdoc that I did in Paris. The word is quite sounds super abstract, and so I think a good way to think about it is to start from classical chaos and how do we understand dynamical systems classically. So we typically have a phase space, which is the collection of the allowed variables that we can have. And then we describe equation of motion, which describe the evolution, let's say, of this system. And then if there is no dissipation or no other dissipative forces, we have the Hamiltonian, which describes, let's say, the dynamics of the system. And then classically we define a chaotic system if two nearby trajectories, let's say, that are displaced by a little bit, they separate exponentially in time, this butterfly effect. But then when you go to quantum systems, things change a bit, and the first way to understand this kind of issues is to take a class semi-classical limit. So to have h bar, you include h bar, but now h bar is small. The first thing that I want to say that it's a common misconception. So it's usually people say, the problem with quantum chaos is that the equation of motion, that the Schrödinger equation is linear in psi. So if you don't have non-linearities, then you cannot have chaos, which is not true in the sense that also if you think about Liouville equation for phase space density, that is linear. Okay, so what you really should think is like equation of motion for observables in the Heisenberg picture. And there are non-linearities. So I think the problem is not with the non-linearities that are missing. So I want to say this because it's a very common misconception that people say, the Schrödinger equation is linear.
So just because I will try to slow things down because I'm the experimentalist. If you picture phase space, let's say, you have some particle and the phase space is all the momentums and all the positions that the particle can have. And the equation of motion gives you different trajectories in this.
Yes,
space.
It's the rule. So you start from some initial condition and then the equation of motion tell you the rule of update in time of how this particle. So there is, let's say, a function which is telling you how things move. And this function is the Hamiltonian, that is a function of all phase space variables.
And so what you said about introducing the quantumness. Like in the classical picture, we would say our particle is at a point which has no no volume,
yeah,
and it moves on a line which has no so your phase space trajectory is a line in a mm-hmm. space, mm-hmm. and if you now introduce this h bar,
yes, so what you should picture is a wave packet,
yeah.
It's a wave distribution which has the smallest width that it can have. It's defined by h bar. So now each bar is telling you the resolution, basically, yeah. in this phase space, in this classical limit. So the classical limit is sending this h bar to zero, which is sending this width to zero, so you go back to a point. But now for every finite h bar, you will always have finite resolution, let's say, of this.
So indeed, what the quantumness adds is that these trajectories now start to over... Like, if you have classically this chaos, you are saying that if I start here or here... I can diverge, but in the quantum case, like if I start very close to each other, my phase space volume now will overlap to begin with.
Yes, let's say that you can now imagine to study this chaos in this classical limit from the two points. So you have your wave packet and you can picture it by starting at the two points at the end of the wave packet, you know. And so you have this this ball or this grain of uncertainty, and this uncertainty will grow.
Yeah.
So until up to a time in which this uncertainty is, let's say, small compared to the size of your system, then you can treat the system at a semi-classical level. So you can still picture if the uncertainty spreading is small, so you can still think about it in a classical way.
Yeah, yeah. If you like, you can think of your wave packet as a little ball.
Absolutely.
And it will stay a little ball.
It will stay a little ball. The fluctuations, so the uncertainty will start to distort a little bit, but you can keep this picture. So and only after there is a time scale that is defined in semi-classical, which is the Ehrenfest time scale. It's the time scale at which this wave packet becomes a pancake which is too large, so you cannot, when these fluctuations are too large, you cannot use anymore this kind of classical intuition. And so after that, quantum dynamics kick in and there is interference between all these different trajectories, and then there are more sophisticated ways to treat semi-classically this interference between trajectories, but that it's different afterwards.
And intuitively, if I think of this little ball, one of the things that, of course, can happen is that your particle spreads over a big region of phase
mm-hmm,
space.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess more interesting is when your particle phase space volume starts to be disconnected or not. Like, let's say you have your little mm-hmm, ball and mm-hmm, it splits into... Mm-hmm.
I mean, so this can happen, but usually due to recoherence effect. So Suppose you now have this little ball. This little ball distorts, so it starts becoming a
cigar.
So Zurek calls it a hyperdimensional pancake. So you have this pancake that evolves, and then it will, at a certain time, it will become as big as the allowed phase space. So this is like the time scale after which you should not think anymore classically when it's too large. But then due to like quantum coherence effect, for instance, if you study this dynamics on top of a sphere, you start from a ball, and then at long times, there are interference effect, and this ball can become a GHZ state. Yes. Due to interference effect. And then it goes on, it again somehow occupies some allowed phase space, but then it recoheres. But those kind of interferences that make this wave packet to go in disconnected regions, so to become, for instance, at GHZ, this is quantum interference. Yeah. So.
And I mean, it's fair to say this cannot be completely new physics, because Aaron Fest died whatever before the Second World War.
No, I think in this sense, yes.
A lot of this has been known.
Yeah, has been known. So there are new ideas that then one can study in this. Even just this very simple semi-classical picture, like the study of entanglement. So now if you have your wave packet, but you wonder how much the right and the left of the wave packet, so how much the entanglement between the right and the left spreads in time. So this is also an old concept, but I would say we started getting more and more interesting on this topic more recently because of the reasons we know. So now really thinking about entanglement in this kind of settings, it's a more modern view on this kind of semi-classical systems.
So chaos is this sensitivity to initial conditions, and there is a change, like in the quantumness, the initial conditions are fuzzy to begin with. Is that...
Yes, they're fuzzy to begin with, but I think as long as h bar is small, there is a way. So as long as you can have this Ehrenfest time to be large, and so typically if the dynamics is chaotic, so you should think about define it as the time for which the size of your wave packet becomes large as the allowed phase space. But if the dynamics is chaotic, then this wave packet grows, the size of this wave packet, so size of quantum fluctuations, go exponentially fast in time. So it starts from h bar, it ends with the volume of phase space. So this time is the logarithm of 1 of h bar. So if h bar is very small, this time scale can be arbitrarily long. And before this time scale, you can define the Lyapunov exponent in this semi-classical sense. Now, the question is different if your h bar is equal to 1. So if you are in the full quantum regime of many body systems where there is no small parameter, and this is the case, for instance, of spin chains or like systems of many qubits where you don't have any external parameter to send to 0, so in that case, you cannot really define a Lyapunov exponent because there is no trajectory. So it would be wrong to picture things. So this is when things become hard, because you cannot use anymore this picture of a ball in phase space, and you somehow need new intuition, new mathematics to describe what's happening. But in the pure quantum regime, there is no Lyapunov exponent. So this is
The example of the easy system is like harmonic oscillators, right? Because they somehow, like, we teach them to students early on. And the beauty of the harmonic oscillator, even if you generalize it to more dimensions or whatever, it always stays in this semi-classical limit.
Yes,
right?
I think even more in the harmonic oscillator, somehow they have no interaction. So everything is quadratic. So everything stays an harmonic oscillator, both in classical and quantum.
Yeah. So you have
mechanics.
This perfect correspondence between the classical equation of motion and the quantum.
They are the same. They're exactly the same. Now, the problem with when you have a system made of many particles with no small parameter and with interactions. And so in that case, it's harder to define what does it mean to be chaotic. And so we theorists had to come up with different kind of approaches, statistical approaches, to describe what does it mean, yes, to be generic. So what does it mean to be chaotic? And I would say that one of the ways that now we have, the most established way to understand thermal equilibrium or chaotic or ergodic dynamics is to use what's called the eigenstate thermalization hypothesis, which is, so you see, this is where the math becomes important, because one of the main features now in this quantum business is that your Hamiltonian is now an operator, so it's a matrix, so you have discrete energy levels. So really, to describe what's happening to your system, you should think about the eigenvalues and the eigenvectors. And so part of the most successful quantum chaos starting from Wigner in the 50s, but then really in the 80s, was seeing that these eigenvalues and eigenvectors shared many statistical properties with random matrices. So now the modern way we have to understand, let's say, chaotic dynamics of many body states is to use random matrix theory. So you have to picture a matrix in which the entries are randomly distributed. And so the way to do it now in quantum systems, the matrix that you look at is the matrix of some physical observable, like the density of particles or magnetization, in the basis of the energy. And so this matrix is almost random. And this is the way now we understand thermalization and...
So this is also where numerics comes in, because I guess random matrix theory is like great for numerics.
So on one side, it's also great for mathematics, and there is a huge field in math and also in mathematical physics. So here in Cologne, I mean, there is Martin Zimbauer, Alex Salzman, there are many other, or also in the math department, experts. So the way we understand it in quantum system is more like an hypothesis. So the numerics comes in when you want to check whether this sort of random matrix description applies or not. So the exact statement of this eigenstate thermalization hypothesis is, if you look at these matrix elements of physical observables in the basis of the energy, this matrix is almost random, looks random, so it's a pseudo-random matrix, but it has smooth statistical properties. So, for instance, the diagonal are a smooth function of the energy density, and this smooth function should correspond to the microcanonical function. So it's really a way to incorporate statistical mechanics, like the one that we studied in our undergrad, where you have a microcanonical ensemble, on top of the fact that your actual description is quantum. So at the bottom you have quantized levels and they are discrete. Where there is this emergent randomness that you have to deal with.
And physically, what is thermalization for a quantum system?
Yeah, so I see it like in a very similar way as in classical systems. So imagine you have a drop of ink in a glass of water or some Campari in your Prosecco, if you want to make a spritz. So you put this drop and then you wait. So the ink starts to diffuse, or like this, the Campari, and then it attains a stationary state in which the ink is completely melted. Melted, mixed,
dissolved.
Mixed, yeah. with water. So in quantum system, the way now we have to make statements is somehow to have the same perspective. So you think about this local observable, like magnetization on a single site. If you have a many body, and you look at how this local observable evolves in time. So it will start from, say, if you start from a fully polarized initial state and you're studying the magnetization along Z, it will start from plus one, and then you evolve with some interacting qubit Hamiltonian, and then this will evolve in time, and then it will saturate, will attain a stationary value, which you want it to be described by statistical mechanics. So to make sense of this kind of out of equilibrium relaxation, you need eigenstate thermalization hypothesis. So if you want to see where this kind of process is inscribed in your mathematics, so in your matrix elements, so you need these assumptions.
And naively, of course, with a drop of ink or Campari, it doesn't matter where you put the drop initially into the glass, because the final state is that it will be everywhere. And so I guess one of the big things is that it can actually matter, like the, so your like that that sort of would be the analogy of your initial state doesn't matter to where you thermalize.
Yeah, that's a very good question. So indeed, when we have this description somehow, what we only care, for instance, if the energy is conserved, is the initial energy density of your initial state. So what we're saying is basically, okay, every initial state with the same energy density will attain a stationary state which locally looks the same. So this is the way. But now there is the interesting connection with entanglement, because what we know is that at the same time, unitary evolution keeps the state pure. So if you start with a pure state and you evolve it in time, the global information should be conserved. But then when you look locally, you see only thermal things. So what's the solution of this paradox is that actually quantum correlations are being spread non-locally in entanglement. So your initial condition is like spread non-locally over all degrees of freedom through the growth of entanglement.
So basically this is back to your inspiration of entanglement being something that actually looks random. But it's not.
Yeah.
Like it looks locally random, but it's globally determined.
Exactly. Absolutely. Yeah.
All right. Cool. I was more scared that I would that you would lose me very quickly. But you are very good at explaining this.
Yeah.
So we have established indeed entanglement and locality plays a very important role in this chaos, and so far we talked about a system which conserves energy and which conserves purity.
Yeah.
So that is a closed system.
Exactly, a closed quantum system, in which is some sort of in principle, it's very hard to isolate quantum systems, but given the incredible progresses in the field of quantum simulation, one can now probe this kind of pure quantum dynamics up to relatively long timescales if you compare to the ones of like standard condensed matter.
Yeah.
So this somehow has allowed the theories to come up with all sorts of questions that before were really inconceivable, I would say.
Do you think the wave function is real or is it a mathematical object?
Well, as long as it describes what we see, it's real.
And indeed, the mass that is based on it checks out in most cases.
Yeah, exactly. But then it becomes a question of what is reality, no?
I mean, it's such a horrible question because the problem is that for the single system, you can never just measure the wave function for a closed system completely.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You have
to sort of make multiple copies or... This is kind of, I don't know, this philosophical thing is a bit
Someone told me that... Physicists that study quantum foundations before they're 40... They're silly, they're wasting their time, but physicists that do not worry about quantum foundations after they're 40, they're silly and they should be doing that. So I still have some time before.
But you also have found a permanent job now. I think that's like...
I can go to quantum foundations.
Exactly now. Like you first have to establish yourself. And then I think there's this story with Bell as well, right? That he had to sort of find something to pay his salary, and then he was doing this quantum foundations in his spare time.
Yeah. I think even at the time, what he was doing was really considered a philosophy, and also Bell was coming from a very poor family, so he didn't have he wasn't so lucky to be thinking about to have the time to think about philosophical. But then it was very important also that he could, no? Because otherwise, our life would be totally different. So it's good at a certain point not to discard the philosophical questions. And
shall we briefly? I don't know. We can also briefly, in this context of wave functions, quantum and reality, mention this Hyperion.
Ah, yes.
Thing, right?
So, this is nice. So actually, there is an old paper by Zurek So he was one of the first ones who really, like in this kind of classical, semi-classical setting, was worrying about entanglement. I mean, okay, because at the time, this was more like a hippie kind of community, and only very people which were quite kind of free could think about, would think about these questions. And so his problem is exactly going to what I was saying before. So that semi-classical description should hold up to this Ehrenfest time. So this time scale, which is like the logarithm of h bar to the minus one. Okay. So then he took the problem very seriously and said, okay, h bar is small, very small, but it's not zero. So he thought about a problem where one could actually see the quantum effect. So where this Ehrenfest time should have been, and then he made a calculation, I remember how it should have been, of 20 years. So he was thinking about the Hyperion, which is the moon, which is a moon that is somehow stumbling chaotically. So the orbit, its orbit is non-chaotic, but then the orientation of his
it's sort of a weird potato shape.
Exactly.
Kind of
so it's changing randomly, and so he was wondering, and somehow how come that we see its random motion is not so we are still describing it in a classical way, it's not blurred, so that the quantum fluctuation don't blur it. And so the solution that he came across with is the interaction with the environment, as we were saying. So that actually the Hyperion is entangled with the photons, with the dust but what we see is only locally Hyperion. So we're tracing out the other degrees of freedom. So locally we see classical things. And this is the Ein selection of Wojciech Zurek, which...
it's pretty mind-blowing stuff. I think, I mean, just even the, how do you say, I mean, it takes a lot of guts to say what's the wave function of an astronomical object.
You have to be Zurek.
So far we have talked about this closed systems. You work mainly on closed systems.
I work mainly on closed systems, yes.
But that are out of equilibrium.
That are out of equilibrium, yeah, exactly. So I work on dynamics of systems which are mainly described by the Hamiltonian. But now, since I arrived in Cologne, somehow I started to also be interested in the interplay of this unitary evolution with measurements, which is something that here in Cologne are very, very experts on. I'm thinking about Sebastian Diel, Michel Buchholz, and many others, so also Alex Altan, etc. So now I'm also starting to think about the interplay with measurements and if we can use it to prepare states which have some cool properties. But mainly, I'm mainly a closed quantum system person.
Talking about eigenstates, could you tell us more about scars?
Yeah, okay, thank you for this question. So let's we can start from maybe an experiment. Mm-hmm. So the experiment which made this name to come back in the popular news, where popular is among us. So there was this very beautiful experiment in the group of Michalukin with Rydberg atoms. So they had this array of Rydberg atoms, and then it's really a quantum simulator, so they can initialize. So this array of Rydberg atoms is driven in such a way that the effective description of the Hamiltonian is a two-level system, which this interacts through some dipole-dipole interaction. And so they did this experiment in which they were doing this kind of drop of ink in a glass of water experiment. So they were initializing the system and then looking at some magnetization. And then for what we said, typically every initial state with the same energy density should have the same dynamics. But then what they found was something very special, that if you initialize your state from a charge density wave, so from up-down, they found very slow oscillations. And this was in absence of disorder or symmetries or any other like kind of mechanism that at the moment could explain this dynamics, which was strongly depending on the initial state. So only afterwards people realize that the reason for this to happen is that the eigenstates, so now again this mathematical description answer, the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian that is describing the evolution have a very strange structure. So most of the eigenstates almost all of them have this thermal structure, so they are smooth in energy and obey this eigenstate thermalization hypothesis. But then there were few, only n of them instead of 2 to the n, only n of them which were really athermal. So they had very different entanglement, very different expectation value of magnetization, for instance. And so the idea is that when they initialize on a random initial state, they would somehow excite all the eigenstates in the bulk of this thermal eigenstates. But then for this charge density wave, they were somehow, these initial states were overlapping only with these special athermal eigenstates, and this somehow explains this oscillation. And the name so was given afterward by Turner and the group of Zlatko Papic, Maxim Serbin, and Dima Banin, and they called them many-body quantum scars, in analogy with something that was discussed at the early 80s, which are scars in semi-classical systems. So now we can go back to this classical description with small h-bar, and there the way to understand chaos from the eigenstates, one would expect that these eigenstates are random, let's say, so if you look at their distribution in phase space, should look like flat, uniform distribution. But then Heller in 77 realized that there were some eigenstates, and that when you looked at the distribution in phase space, the distribution was very strangely picked around some unstable trajectories. So some trajectories that in the classical limit were corresponding to unstable trajectories. So the eigenstates had a scar of their unstable classical limit. So these were the scars in the semi-classical physics. And now we are in the many-body setting. So this kind of eigenstates that were discovered have been called many-body quantum scars. And from that moment on, they've attracted a lot of attention. I would say that now one can say that many theoretical physicists have scars in their past, in the sense that this kind of phenomena, they have been studied for a long time with different names. So I know in the cluster, at least, Hakim Rosh had scars in his past, and Martin Zimbauer was telling us that also Dyson knew that. It's a non-fact. You can expect that few eigenstates are non-random and are athermal. Somehow now the community of out of equilibrium has started really to understand how to construct them and how to create a generic local Hamiltonians in which you have these special states and etc.
To go back to the ink. Is there a way to give an ink in the glass analogy of this? It's like the ink cannot go everywhere. Depending on how you put it in, there's certain places that it will be more peaked at, and then it will sort of.
So the analogy, the simpler analogy, because the ink is already like a many body.
Oh, yeah.
So when you have a many-body case, it's harder to imagine the trajectory of the individual particles. So the simpler analogy is to think about one particle in a billiard. Okay, so you know that in this kind of billiards, mathematicians love them because they can prove things that are really hard.
It's also examples of ergodicity, depending on how the table looks.
Exactly.
You will have places that go everywhere on the table.
Yeah, exactly. So actually, also classical chaos, it's super hard to deal with mathematically, and there are very few examples of proven chaotic ergodic system. So one of these is the one you're saying, this Sinai billiard, in which you have a square, and then you put a hole in the middle, and that was proved by Sinai to be chaotic. But in general, it's hard. So now, so let's think about this example in which you have a billiard which is chaotic. So because of the shape of the billiard, you should be having chaotic dynamics. So most of the trajectories of one particle, you can also think now of one particle, most of the trajectories will feel at long times uniformly. But now you can think about some trajectories. So this is where it would be nice to have a picture. Some trajectories which, for instance, in your billiard, just go vertically on top and on the bottom. So these are these are good trajectories, but they're unstable in the sense that as you perturb from them, you will explore again. So they're very rare trajectories. And so in this picture, the scars are those eigenstates which have a support which is strongly peaked around these unstable trajectories.
Which is not ergodic.
Which is not ergodic, exactly.
Which will not go everywhere.
And it will not go everywhere. Yeah. So if you initialize your wave packet on top of this, somehow you will your wave packet will have will dynamics stay, yeah. on this.
So indeed, we should briefly maybe mention for some of the not as, like ergodic is a big word, but it just means that you go every, like that yeah. you explore the entire face.
Yeah, right? yeah. So yeah. so the concept of ergodicity in classical StatMech is invoked to say that, the rigorous statement is that face space, so average at long times, they can be substituted with average over face space. So what it means in this picture is that you have this particle and you wait long enough and then the particle will be more or less, will visit more or less everywhere compatible with its energy. So this is ergodicity, yeah.
And indeed, the scars mean that instead of sampling everywhere all at once, you have some peaks that will
yes,
be more
likely. Yes, so that the scars is that, so the equivalence of ergodicity in quantum systems, now it's given by this eigenstate thermalization hypothesis, which says that all eigenstates, every eigenstate should look thermal, so should basically explore all its allowed Hilbert space at a given energy, should be random and uniform at a given energy. But now these scars, somehow, they're really far from this. So these are eigenstates, which are really far from this being uniform at a certain energy. And in the classical limit, you understand, it has a clear analogy with these unstable trajectories. But you can do it only in these semi-classical models. So now in this many-body context, there is no obvious classical limit. So now you have many-body quantum scars, and in principle, you do not have trajectories anymore. So now they're just eigenstates which are away from the thermal bubble.
And as an experimentalist, I'm proud because this was experiment leading theory, in a sense.
Yeah, no, this is, in fact, I think it's one of the nicest examples in this field of quantum simulation in which really the experiments led the theory. So they discovered this behavior. It was not clear why it was there and what was the issue. And then theorists explained it. This is like how physics is usually, that experimentalists discover things and then theorists try to explain it. But in quantum simulation, very often it's the contrary. So it's more that...
There's models like, I don't know, the Dicke model or some other model, and then the experimentalists just try to make the model.
Yeah, exactly. exactly. But this was very different, and I like this a lot because it really pushed the theorist somehow to think harder.
And in the context of quantum computing, these scars, can they be used as qubits?
No, that's an interesting question. I think that now people are thinking about what can you do with these scars, because definitely they are somehow subsectors of the Hilbert space, which in principle are decoupled from the rest. So you can think about several questions like, can I, for instance, as you said, can I use them to make qubits? The problem there is the problem of stability. Mm-hmm. So how stable they are. And the known, like many of the methods that many of the constructions of these scars are believed to be very unstable, which is mm-hmm. not very great news. But there are other systems where you can see that they're actually robust. So, for instance, recently we showed that systems with long-range interactions, where for instance, you have two qubits which interact via power law, which depends on some rate alpha, let's say, and these are kind of effective Hamiltonians for trapped ions, for cavity QAD and many other models. So these kind of long-range interacting systems, they have scars which are stable. So this is one example. Then another question going into the direction, what do we do with these scars, that I find interesting is somehow the metrological aspect of entanglement. So entanglement can be used to make very precise measurements. more precise that you could do with classical states. And so also the scars have a very useful entanglement. So they have entanglement which could be used for phase estimation protocols.
Yeah.
This is also something we've been working on.
Yeah, we didn't get to this yet. I mean, indeed, Zurak also this idea, to some extent, you can also view decoherence as entanglement. So there is sort of useless entanglement and there's useful entanglement.
Yeah, so in the case of Zurek, so he needs entanglement to explain classicality. So going back also to this Hyperion example, in the sense that your system gets entangled with the environment, but then you don't look at the environment. Yeah. So when you look at things locally, you see like classical uncertainty.
Something random, yeah.
Exactly. And now somehow the entanglement it's like more useful. No, so
yeah, I mean, it's not a closed, it's not an open system.
Yeah, but
it's when
you keep your state pure.
Yeah.
And in that sense, also there, now once you have a state which is pure, there are different kind of entanglement. So there is the entanglement on a bipartition, which is quantified by the entanglement entropy, the von Neumann entropy, or there is entanglement which can be used for metrology, which is multipartite entanglement, and that's another story.
Brings up the question of quantum Fisher information.
Yeah.
So it's a sort of an entanglement witness, I think. And does it only give you the size of the system that is the most entangled? Does it also like help you classify what kind of entanglement is there? Since we're talking about multiple regions that are entangled.
Yeah, thank you for the question. So just to say to the audience what is the quantum Fisher information. So related more to this second question that we were discussing, this kind of useful entanglement. So in metrology and in quantum optics, people were wondering what is the best precision that I can achieve doing some phase estimation protocol. So and this best precision is bounded by, let's say, 1 over the quantum information. This is a quantity that is defined also in classical inference. And now you can define in a operational way, you can define the quantum Fisher information. So in this sense, this quantity tells you something about how good is your measurement protocol. And this quantum Fisher information has been shown after to be a witness of entanglement, and in particular of multipartite entanglement. So in particular from the value that this quantum Fisher information has, as you were saying, one can say about the structure of the entanglement, in the sense you can make a bound on the number of particles which are entangled to each other. Somehow, what is the size of the entangled blocks? It quantifies the entanglement depth, etc. But you ask a very nice question, which is it telling me something only about the size or also about the strength? Mm. And I think it tells you something only about the size.
Okay.
So how many particles or how big is this block of entangled qubits, let's say.
This is one of the topics that you're working on.
Yeah, this is one of the big topics I'm working on. So besides quantum chaos, is this kind of multipartite entanglement. Because I like this idea that you can use this sort of entanglement for metrology. Now, again, I'm a theorist, so I think that maybe then from characterizing the entanglement, then to use it, there is a leap, which I should go through. But I like the idea of using dynamics as a way to generate states which have a lot of useful entanglement. So as the one witnessed by the quantum Fisher information.
Also for me, this metrology story, I don't know, for me as an experimentalist, part of this got me into quantum into the job, because this question, how can you most accurately measure something, I think has been really, really a fascinating driver of quantum stuff. And I mean, for me, it was more from the side of like sort of this Carlton Cave story. And I mean, like the fact that people use this quantum metrology ideas to detect gravitational waves is just mind blowing.
Yeah, yeah, no, it's very nice because now the idea is that if you do these phase estimation protocols with quantum particles which are entangled, so for instance, or if they have so if they have some quantum properties like squeezing also, then you can beat the classical limit. So in the example that you did in LIGO, they really used a squeezed vacuum inside of one of their interferometer branches to beat the shot noise limit. Yeah, which I agree. Also to me, when I saw that as an undergrad, I was really impressed.
It's also something that we should not always just focus on quantum computing and tell people about, you know, that we will, I don't know, cure cancer, feed the world, to solve climate change. But we should just focus on some of these aspects of where we can point to and where we can say quantum mechanics is already, mm-hmm. you know, changing the way that we see the world. And I mean, yeah, the SCARS example is also really this example of us building quantum machines that help us discover physics in a new way.
Yeah, totally. I agree.
You just started this year in Cologne, and you're transitioning to being a professor on your own. Is it a transition for you?
Yeah, it's a transition. I was a postdoc, and I was a postdoc in France, where I think the way that academia is structured is very different. And so people work in smaller groups, they do not talk much. And so there are many new things here about the structure of groups, supervising, teaching, and having really these big collaborations like this cluster, which really it looks amazing to me because it really somehow pushes people to make an effort to try to talk. And then you discover that many people can really like teach each other things and then make very interesting works. Maybe in France people work exactly on the same topic in two doors, but all the doors are closed. there are many things that I'm learning.
And so right now you have one PhD student?
Yes, I have one PhD student and I have an internship student and I will have new openings coming on next year for PhDs. So to who listens, don't hesitate to drop me an email and ask me if you're interested.
So Italy seems to have a larger percentage of women pursuing science or physics. What is your view on that as compared to other countries? What do you think is the reason that that's the case?
Yeah, that's a good question. So because this came up during one of the meetings, the last ML4Q meeting. First of all, I wanted like to check the numbers. And I think this is already interesting that, for instance, in Italy, there is a very good gender budget done by the Italian Physical Society, and here in Germany it was very hard to find one look at the numbers.
The numbers were outdated.
They were outdated, and there is not like a structured file which is updated. And I think it's very important to count, especially when we discuss about the gender issues, so to have the data. So this was somehow. But okay, so I can tell you the data for Italy in 2021. They were in universities, so hired. There are 22%, so if this is good compared to Germany, well, it could be, it's interesting, but already, someone said a comment, which I believe is true, that one of the reasons is that in Italy, salaries are lower, and so it's somewhat seems to be less competitive. I don't think that it's perceived as less competitive academia in Italy. So, but this is a point. Another point, which I believe it's partly the cause, is that many women maybe start exact sciences to teach, and maybe in Italy they are not two different curricula. So you just start math and physics, and then you maybe, so you started with the idea of teaching, but you end up doing research. This is certainly the case of math. For instance, in math, there are much larger percentages of women in Italy, I can say. And definitely because traditionally, if you wanted to teach in high school, you had to do math, not physics. So it's... But then I have another conjecture, which I don't, could be would be interesting to establish, which is the absence of this myth of the genius. So I feel that that in many countries to be a physicist you have to there is this myth that you have to be a genius since you're two. You look at Apple and then you derive gravity, and you have to be obsessed with it since you're very young. And I believe in Italy it's not really like this, in the sense that what you're most encouraged to is to pursue what you like, and also knowledge is more about passion, and also you don't have to choose when you're very young whether you're going to become a genius or not. You should pursue what you like. And this comes in practical things. So for instance, you can go and study classical studies up to when you are 18 and never have seen physics, and then go to physics at the university. So this is what I did, but many other people. So in a sense, I mean, Italy's Catholic, so it always forgives. So you can always start from scratch. But I think this removes a bit this aura of being a genius as a necessary condition for becoming a physicist.
You say it's Catholic, but I think in some sense it's quite progressive to think of it that way.
I also think you're a great example, because you can become a professor at 30 without having a bachelor at 12.
Yeah.
That's quite encouraging.
Then I think in my case, my mom is a mathematician. So this this is something that I also, why I believe that models are very important.
Yes.
So she's a professor at the university, and definitely, so even picturing myself was possible.
Yeah.
You know, I think makes it much easier, for instance, for me than for other people.
I had also read somewhere, probably this is not true, but that the children inherit their intelligence from their mother.
It's possible. Yeah. It's all in the mitochondria, where the men do not contribute at all. But I mean, maybe we can, we had a good time, and to close up, I would just like to highlight that on this podcast, we had 2/3 women.
Okay.
So it's very, very progressive. Mm-hmm. I'm going to congratulate my
And now you have 50% co-hosting.
Yes. Yeah, that's that we like. Yes.
So thanks a lot for being here.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much for having me in this conversation.
We learned a lot about quantum chaos, which is, again, a preconceived idea that it is something very difficult.
Thank you. Yeah.